The Sands is proud to present a wonderful new show, A Man and His Music. The music of Count Basie and his great band. And the man.
Hey, it's Jim from King's Comics, and I'm here on Signal of Doom, so stick around.
Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello, you're at Signal of Doom and you're with Dave. I'm here with Jim from King's Comics, a star of the business, manager of many years at King's. He's often mentioned on the show. Jim, welcome to Signal of Doom.
G'day, mate. How are you?
It's like deja vu, isn't it, Jim? It's like we had this conversation about 5 minutes ago and, you know, are we in an alternate universe or...?
No, I thought it was just my old age coming back to hit me, you know. Have I done this before?
Now, Jim, what the audience would love to know is, I mean, you're obviously the manager at King's, and it feels like you've been there forever for me because you're one of the first people I saw when I walked into that store, 2001, 2002, fresh off the Spider-Man movies, and I was like, wow, this bright, colourful store, so neatly organised. Is this really a comic store? And I mean, you did a fantastic job, Jim, and I think that was the first impression I had. Tell the listeners how you came to be a manager at King's and what was your journey to getting there?
Oh, man, look, I mean, I was introduced to King's back in about 99, where I was doing a completely different job to what I'm doing now.
Assassin?
I wanted to get...
That's what I was. Assassin?
Not quite as well paid as that.
Okay.
I just wanted to get out of the job and do something that I really enjoyed. And I've always enjoyed comics from when I was very young, learning to read through, you know, comics like Asterix and Peanuts, even Archie comics, because I lived in growing up in a house which my parents only spoke Greek. I went to school knowing almost no English.
Sure.
So comics actually helped me learn to read.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and I got onto George because there was a the owner of the business, George. There was a job opening, and I went for it, and yeah, he hired me, and for some reason hasn't fired me since.
You pledge your case. You just come on, man. Give me a job. A little bit of desperation.
I need a job, and I need a job. You know, doing something I really enjoy, and as you do with just about any job, you start at the bottom, you get trained, and within about 2 or 3 years, I was managing the store out at Fox Studios that we had.
Oh, okay.
And then when that shut down because of, you know, there were a lot of reasons behind
Fox Studios being a ghost town at the time wouldn't have probably helped.
Yeah, look, I mean, it wasn't like that in the beginning, but it eventually got like that, yeah. And we just focused on the one we have now on Pitt Street.
I always say, Jim, that I personally think, I mean, you are the premier location in Sydney, and I would argue maybe even in Australia. Like, it is one of those stores you walk into. I went into it again recently, and I'm just, you know, the amount of merchandise you've got in there for starters, it is mind-boggling. You know what I'm saying? Like, you walk in there and you're like, wow, there's a lot going on.
Well, we try not to kind of narrow ourselves. We try to get a little bit of everything because, you know, you can't just get stuff that you like.
Oh, no.
You got to kind of have that flow in the store where you can go from your classic comic book stuff like your Batman and your Superman, your Captain America, etc. But you got to go into the manga. You got to go into the Ghibli. You got to go into European comics. You got to go into just a bit of everything. And that's what I like doing, you know, whenever I'm – because I get to order all the stuff most of the time for the store, and I like a diversity.
Yeah, well, man, I've definitely got some questions about that because, I mean, I would 100% agree, because that is how you broaden your audience too, isn't it? Like the people who come in, you need a broad selection to sell.
Well, yeah, I mean, it'd be like a supermarket that just sells cheese.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do that. There are people out there who find it very difficult to certain things, but we try to make that easier.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Jim, I've got a question. What was your introduction to comics? Was it Asterix? Was it the comic book strips? And do you remember how old you were?
Yeah, man. I can still remember it. Like I said, I went to kindergarten, and on the first day there, the teacher started realizing that I couldn't speak really a word of English. I had no right. idea what was going on, you know, not as opposed to now. But to help me, I guess, get interested in books, and this became a lifelong obsession with me, not just comic books but novels.
Sure.
My kindergarten teacher gave me an Asterix and an Archie comic.
Fantastic.
And despite the fact that I couldn't read what they were saying, but with the pictures and what was going on, I eventually got to the point where I wanted to learn what was going on. I wanted to read this. I wanted to see what was going on in the comic. And it just went from there. So I would have been all of like, yeah, just around 5 years old, man.
Wow. So it's really meant to be then, isn't it? Like if you've been doing it since you were like five.
It was my density. I got there eventually. I worked a whole lot of jobs in retail most of the way through my life, but eventually fell into King's Comics, and I just didn't want to fall back out.
Yeah, well, it seems like an excellent working environment from what I've seen when I've been there. do you remember, Jim, because this is one thing we like to do on the show, do you remember the cost of comics when you started? Like, you know, because back in the day, you know, we're roughly the same age, it was pretty much newsstands. That's where I was buying stuff. Was that where it was for you?
Yeah, because, I mean, other than maybe Comic Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
at the time there would not have been any specialty stores.
The late unlamented Comic Kingdom.
Yeah, like, well, you know, man, having Comic Kingdom at the very least was the foundation for comic book stores in Sydney, if not Australia.
Oh, were they there a long time? I only know them from I popped in a few times.
Pretty much
know?
The first.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay.
So, you know, having them recently, you know, closed down was a real sad thing.
Sure, but, of course, yeah.
I mean, back when I was getting them, just like you, off the newsstands, they were, what, they were 30 cents, 35 cents?
Yeah.
Possibly, you know, bartering a donkey.
But it was good for the schoolboy economy, wasn't it? Like, you could get a few things. I remember I was into 2000 AD, which I was down in Hobart, mate, and they were 95 cents, and they went to $1.20, and that was a price hike.
That's out of control.
Yeah, it was. And I remember just being – I walked into the store, 95, threw my dollar down, and the guy's like, kid, 20 more.
I actually remember talking to some of the – guys at DC and Marvel about the price rise in comics, especially over the last 10 years.
Sure.
And as much as people want to you know, put the blame on the publishers themselves, asking $3.99 US or $4.99 US for a comic, from what they've told me, I mean, paper, especially in the United States or in Canada, has doubled in price every year.
Really?
For the last 10 years. Which is why we're seeing more and more expensive comics on the show.
Yeah, it is an expensive hobby. I mean, that's, you know, that's definitely a factor. I remember when I was getting into it, which was about 87-ish, getting Punisher, and it was still on the really crap paper. But it was great, but it was on terrible paper, and then they upchanged it into War Journal on this great new paper, and I was just in heaven. And I imagine that would have been a real shift, because it must have been weird back in like the 70s and 80s with these really great artists, but like the paper quality was not great, you know, like...
Well, the paper quality wasn't great. The colouring hadn't yet, you know, become computer colouring, so it was all hand done.
Mm-hmm.
It was a much more difficult time, I think, especially to get a comic book out on a monthly schedule.
Sure.
Which, you know... There's a lot of titles and creators these days who can't hit a monthly schedule despite having all this new technology to help them out. Back then, it's basically you're a caveman drawing on walls and getting it colored in and getting it done, and it was an immensely time-consuming kind of of a job, but they still managed it.
Yeah. Whereas now it's pretty much I'm not an artist, but like, isn't it pretty much all digital? What most of them do, they do it all digitally. And is that right? Like, or are they still?
I mean, there are strictly digital artists out there, Stefan Zijic, and you know, the guys who just will draw on a tablet or a computer. But your classic kind of, I guess, comic book artists like you, Jim Lee's and Frank Cho, still working on paper.
Okay.
Still right. on that, you know, the oversized kind of paper that gets shrunk down to fit comic books. But, yeah, I mean, eventually, I don't think it's going to be this generation of artists. I think it's going to be the next generation of artists who are probably going to work exclusively with computers and on, you know, on tablets and whatnot up until... Well, this is my theory as well, where comics is eventually going. I think in, you know, 10 or 15 years' time, I think single issues will be strictly digital.
Mate, I mean, I've said this so many times on the show that I think that is I think probably what's holding that back is the economics of the business right now. And, you know, I mean, you're a retailer, so you know all about it. But, yeah, that prediction you've got, Jim, is a prediction I've said on the show many times. Maybe you listen to Signal of Doom and you've heard me say it, mate. I'm not sure.
maybe, yeah. a lot of people have been afraid that if the industry goes digital, it'll go entirely digital. And I don't think that's going to be the case. I think, you know, single issues will be far easier and far less expensive, especially for the publishers to publish online on a monthly schedule, while keeping trade paperbacks in print.
Yeah, that's a question. I mean, because I'm one of these awful people who, for a few years, like, I probably put a couple of your kids through college, mate, with my weekly spend, of the, you know, getting the monthlies. And I loved it for about 3 or 4 years. Like, I was addicted. I was like a Wednesday warrior. But then I switched to the trades and the hardcovers, and that's what my shelves are now. And I imagine I'm not alone. I imagine a lot of people made that switch at some point, you know?
I'm with you. I made that switch quite a long time ago. I still... There's, you know, a core 4 or 5 books that I will still get in single issues because I just enjoy them too much.
What are they, Jim? We'd love to know. What are Jim's big books?
My big books? Okay. The greatest comic book in the world, Savage Dragon.
Savage Dragon, Eric Larson, yes?
I have been I've been a fan since day one of Savage Dragon. Awesome. I absolutely adore that comic.
That's cool, man. That's pretty cool, actually, yeah.
Other than that, I also pick up Saga, singles, because honestly, I honestly can't wait. Anything Terry Moore does, you know, his latest Strangers in Paradise
series. Echo, was it Echo one of his?
Look, anything he touches, I am all over.
Very
I
talented.
Love Terry Moore. And, you know, unfortunately, one that just finished for me, Astro City.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Kurt Busiek,
Although it's going to be continuing as a series of graphic novels.
I've never read that one, and I've only ever heard good things, and I've enjoyed what I've read of him. Would you recommend that heavily then?
Oh, dude, I adore Astro City. It was just – it was so far ahead of its time when it started. Mm. It was just – it's just magic. He takes you know, those superhero tropes, those classic superheroes, and just twists them enough that it's – and entirely cool. I would recommend Astro City to anyone.
That's excellent. We're actually going to do it on the show. It's in our show notes to do later this year, like to kick off with Astro City, because I think it's one of those classics that needs to be looked at. Something I've always found confusing, Jim, is the whole Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, Modern Age. I've even heard Dark Ages of comics. For a long time, I never understood what they were. Drew DeRacy, the DC inker, had to explain it to me. Did you realize this? I mean, I guess you probably did. When they did Golden Age, Silver Age, I always thought it was getting better, but then I'm like, oh, in the historian's eyes, it's getting worse, like going from gold to silver to bronze to sort of dark.
I had that understanding of what Golden Age kind of represented because of, you know, of other things like the Golden Age of cinema.
Sure.
So, yeah, I figured it was pretty cool, but, you know, growing up, I always wanted to read the latest stuff. All the old stuff was just for old people. And
well, I was always like with the old Batmans, I was like, this is Golden Age? But now I'm older and kind of grumpier. I'm like, okay, it is actually pretty good. But like, for a long time. But my question is though, what's your? Everyone has their own personal golden age. What's your personal golden age when it comes to comics? Like, where is that, Jim, for you?
It would have been around, I think, late '70s, early '80s. Jim Aparo, Batman.
Oh yeah, come on, give it up for Jim Aparo.
Batman. There hasn't really been. I mean, I'm talking just kind of, you know, superhero comics.
Sure.
There's not been an age or a run or anything like that in superhero comics for me that's beaten Jim Aparo's Batman run. Mm. It is probably me the best run of superhero comics I've ever read.
And luckily, DC have done a really good job at getting that back out there in hardcovers and trades now.
Yeah, I've been collecting those too, goddammit.
They're damn nice, you know?
Yeah, it's great to see him back in print. He got like a Batman black and white statue and everything. So it's good to see someone who had as much impact, I think, on the characterization of Batman as Neil Adams did,
mm-hmm.
to get people to read his stuff. His take on Batman, it will classic Batman.
Yeah. I mean, I think that look he drew to me is Batman. You know, like, you know, with the blue and the yellow circle he did.
He made him look, I think,
the pointy ears. I love the tall ears that he did, the proper ears.
Oh, dude, yes.
Yeah.
But he also, as far as the body structure was concerned, I think he made him look more realistic, more human than what you saw with some of the other guys out there, whether it was your Frank Millers or your Ed McGuinnesses or whatever.
Mm.
Batman looked like an athlete.
Yeah, he was kind of like almost quite lithe. He was he looked, yeah, you're right, like he was sort of built, but he wasn't stacked, you know? Like,
yeah, he made him look like an athlete or, you know, at least a human who's at the top of his game physically.
Mm, I remember when I was growing up, they did the one where, is it Death in the Family, where Robin, Jason Todd, gets killed? And that was Jim Aparo on art, wasn't it?
When he was voted to death.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I remember that they had those issues on the newsstand when I was buying them, and that was my introduction to his artwork. I know it's later in his career, but it was very iconic, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, nothing like Death in the Family had been done before.
Yeah, it's crazy. Which way did you vote, Jim? Did you call in? Did you vote?
No, because it was. I think by the time I got to those issues, it was too late. I would vote to kill him.
I would have definitely voted to kill that little prick.
Jason Todd.
I mean, I know he's come back, but I still can't stand him. Like, I know they're like, he's back, he's Red Hood. I'm like, yeah, and he still sucks.
He's still whiny. I don't know. I mean, it's. I guess because for me, my favorite Robin, I guess, is still Tim Drake.
Sure,
because he's always been the detective. He's always been the one that I always kind of saw would take over as Batman once Bruce retired or got married. No.
What about Tim Drake's awesome. What about Dick Grayson, the original, the classic, the OG?
I think they need to leave Dick Grayson alone and stop. I mean, he broke away from being anything to do with Batman and Robin a long time ago.
Yeah.
Dick Grayson's his own character, his own man. Nightwing is what he is.
Yeah,
I
definitely.
I think they should just that.
It's kind of like he was the OG, but Tim Drake, to me, I agree with you. Tim Drake back in like the 2000s before they kind of ruined him and 90s was just awesome. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think there was the Chuck Dixon series.
Chuck Dixon did I think 100 issues of Robin.
Robin solo series. That was great stuff. Absolutely. Yeah,
definitely. I remember when we did a Nightfall on the show. We've had Chuck on, and I think there's one issue of Nightfall where old Azrael, as Azbat, has him on the, like, pinned to the cave, like choking him. And I'm like, this is when your relationship with Batman breaks down.
That's when I think DC were focusing on the dark in the Dark Knight.
Yeah,
you know, instead of the night. But there are still a lot of, and you can ask my boss about this because anytime something goes wrong in comics, he blames Azrael. There are still so many people out there who just did not get into, you know, the whole Azbats.
Well, it's interesting because we've done, you know how they've recently put out the big hardcover omnibuses of Nightfall. So all three are out now.
There's soft covers now.
Yes, and soft covers, yes. Well, we've done the first two on the show, and the second one was pretty much Azrael, and it was pretty much the first time I'd read it as one piece. It's got its own flavour. You know, like it would have been interesting to read at the time and think this is going to be really it for the future, whereas we know that obviously, you know, Bruce comes back, thank God.
True. I mean, at the time, because, I mean, I've been a long-time reader just on Batman and Detective. At the time, DC did a bang-up job of keeping it a secret. Nobody knew when they released Sword of Azrael that Batman was going to be replaced. He was going to, retire or die.
Sure.
And Azrael would be the new Batman. No one knew. They kept that a secret. And it was the first time that something like this kind of throwaway character they gave a miniseries to became so important. And
I think they did actually a really good job, to be honest. Like, when we read it, I was like, man, this is some pretty good comics. Like, I mean, it's got a great creative teams behind it too, you know, like they've got strong creators.
The miniseries was Joe Quesada, I think, before he went over to Marvel. Joe Quesada did the art for the Sword of Azrael.
Joe Q on DC.
Yeah, man. He's the one. He did like he actually was going to be the regular ongoing artist for Batman at the time, but Marvel snatched him instead.
And how things then turned, you know what I'm saying? Like he's you know, then he went on to found an empire. Okay, now my co-host Stu, who's not here, he's kind of the smart guy on the podcast, has some good questions, and he's actually got a good question. He's got a few for you, Jim, but he's got, is event fatigue a real thing? And was it tough marketing Civil War II, for example? Do sometimes some of the events come out and it's tougher than other times in comics?
We can lay the blame, I guess, at DC's door sometimes for event-driven comics, thanks to Crisis on Planet Earths. But Marvel, I think, were more to blame, especially in the last few years, when they started doing events and then would do another event before the initial event was even over.
I totally agree, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, and when it came to the point of stuff like Secret Invasion, which was good, but then you've got Civil War II, or you've got Civil War II was really hard for us. Really, really, really hard, especially when word got out on just how many tie-in books this event had. I think we sat down and worked it out that if you wanted to collect Civil War II in its entirety, not just the miniseries, but every tie-in, in Aussie dollars, it would have worked out to about $1,100.
Jesus Christ. For Civil War II, as well, a pretty piss-poor event.
For Civil War II. Not the original, but we worked out it would have cost you, about $1,100 to collect the whole thing.
And can I ask, do you get guys who and girls who do that? Do you still get those people, or is the market changed?
Both. We still get people who are long-time collectors and dedicated collectors and don't, even sometimes like me, don't want an unbroken run of something.
Sure.
But that is changing.
Mm.
With the advent of digital and TV and Netflix, et cetera.
These kids with their rock music, basically.
I think they're less worried about collecting than they are just reading, which is a good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, why collect it if you don't want to read it is what I've always thought. That's been my philosophy whenever I've been picking stuff up.
I'm with you. I do know a few people over the years who do collect and then put their, issues directly into a bag and board and into a collection.
Sure.
Unread.
Yeah. And I
made a rule a long, long time ago that I would not buy anything, whether it's a trade paperback or a single issue, that I wouldn't read.
Mm.
If I'm not going to read it, I'm not going to buy it.
If I was worth millions, I'd definitely have a Batcave vault, though, and do that kind of crazy shit. But I'd have to be worth a lot of money to be doing those kind of, stuff. I remember Ed Brubaker was saying that he understood Event Comics did very well for the publishers, but he personally felt they detracted from the story both as a reader and as a writer. I thought that was a pretty penetrating comment from someone who did his fair share of events, over the years.
I think events I think, you know, especially with DC and Marvel, DC just did Dark Knight's Metal.
Yes.
Which was actually a lot of fun.
I thought it was a good event, man, to be honest.
I thought it was a lot of fun to read. It was a goofy kind of thing to do. But if I've been saying it for a while, and I think the guys at work, the guys I work with are sick of me saying it.
Sure.
I would like to have a year, a 12-month section of DC and Marvel doing no events.
Didn't you almost get that with when New 52 came out? Didn't they do about a year or so before they did like Forever Evil or whatever it was?
Yeah, no, but even before that, they had kind of these mini events, which were like, you know, Justice League crossing over with something else and whatnot.
Sure.
But I would like to see just no events, just write good comics, man.
You sort of want what the industry was. That was kind of pre-Secret War in the 80s. Wasn't Secret Wars the moment where they went, shit, we're making a lot of money off this event?
Secret Wars was definitely the one where people just, you know, especially the publishers, all of a sudden had dollar signs in their eyes. Yep. They saw what this was doing, not just for the people who collected then, but word of mouth got out about this, you know, huge crossover, and people started picking it up everywhere.
Yeah,
it was insane.
I've got a question for you. Just spinning out of Secret Wars, this is a bit off the beaten path. You know, the deal's just closed with Disney acquiring Fox. They closed that deal. Yes. I believe it's been reported on over the last 48 hours. Stu on the Signal, he's hot on, because it's always the thing of how will they integrate the X-Men, and I'm like, well, dude, it could just be an alternate universe. They don't really need to worry about it that much. But he loves the idea of doing a Secret Wars kind of like movie. And so you have a few of the X-Men in it?
Yeah, I think he's pretty close to the mark.
Yeah.
We're seeing – it's getting to the point that Marvel movies have been going for, what, 10-plus years now?
Yep.
Eventually they're going to have to replace some of the actors they're using now.
Your RDJs, you know, your Chris Evans, those kind of guys.
So if you were to do a Secret Wars kind of a movie and then maybe just, you know, big – explosion at the end, fresh start, you get some different actors in and go from there. You got yourself another 10 years of Marvel movies.
Do you think they can pay Hugh enough money? Do you think Hugh Jackman can be paid enough money to roll in just one last time? Because I'm a big Hugh Jackman fan. One of our goals on the Signal is actually to get him on the Signal.
If they want to say, you know, come on, just one more, I don't think he'd say no.
I hope so.
Logan was just so fucking good.
It was fantastic. And I do repeat again, if Hugh's listening, you know, the Signal wants you, Hugh. We want you on here. We won't grill you, Hugh. We want to talk X-Men. We'll go for the whole career. we'll do Real Steel. We'll do whatever you need. Now,
it's okay. You can do musicals. Come on.
Oh, definitely. I mean, my God, that last musical he had was fantastic, The Greatest Showman. I thought it was wonderful, actually. It made a lot of money as well. Something that's a huge thing in comic books, which I think reminds me of sports reporting, is like creative team shifting. Like, you know, there's a whole industry now in like comic book reporting. Recently, we had Nick Spencer jump onto Amazing Spider-Man with Dan Slott leaving. Now, look, I read that first issue of Amazing Spider-Man. It blew me away. What was the response at store level, Jim?
We haven't had people this excited about Amazing Spider-Man for a long time.
Mm.
Not just with Nick Spencer on, but I can't remember the artist.
Ryan, someone from the guy from Invincible. Yeah,
which I think Marvel hit the nail on the head with putting him on to Amazing Spider-Man. He's just like the perfect artist for it. But we haven't had, even though people were kind of wary of many of the Fresh Start reboot books, which kind of were a soft start for us, they didn't all do as well as we wanted them to do, especially, I guess, Captain America.
Yep.
But Amazing Spider-Man was a huge hit for us. We overordered, and I think we still ended up selling out.
That's fantastic. You know, I read it, and I love Spider-Man. I'm an old-school Spider-Man fan, and I enjoyed two-thirds of Dan Slott's run, but I got very tired by the end. You know what I mean? I was just over that personification, you know?
He did 10 years, though, so, you know, it's...
Yeah.
He did almost 10 years on Spidey.
Eventually, overall, he gets a high grade, but I was over it. But this fresh injection, I think, was desperately needed, you know?
It's worked on... I can tell you, you know, as far as our sales are concerned.
Sure.
It's worked on Spider-Man. It's worked incredibly well on Venom.
That's great. Donnie Coates, yeah?
Absolutely. Mm. Doctor Strange is doing really well for us. And it's a shame because the titles that used to be great, the X-Men books, are just kind of wallowing with us right now.
Mm.
No one cares.
It's really sad what's happened to the X-Men comics, because I was an X-Men guy I jumped on when the movie. I'm really bad. I jumped on with the first movie, and I really got invested. Yeah, and I got invested, and I read back, and I bought stacks of X-Men. But current X-Men is a snore to me. I just can't get into it. You know.
I agree. I mean, I understand that Marvel is trying to recapture the old X-Men. Blue X-Men Gold, Jim Lee kind of era excitement for it, but it's not there. There's way too many, again, there's way too many X titles out there. Mm. And I'm just not sure that they're treating the characters right. The only X book I'm enjoying right now is Grand Design.
Okay, yeah, that's a really interesting one, actually. That's kind of a very artistic approach.
Yeah, Grand Design's absolutely astounding. But, I mean, as far as any of the regular monthlies or whatnot, I could not care less.
It's just one of those things. At least they're turning Spider-Man around, the franchise. Because I've always said with Marvel, they need to get their X-Men franchise and their Spider-Man franchise working along with their Avengers. And Spider-Man, to me, is pointed upwards, you know?
It is. That and the fact that we're getting Fantastic Four in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You know,
come on.
I am very excited about the Fantastic Four coming back.
Sarah Pacelli really on art, Dan Slott writing, I believe. I'm 1,000% down.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
But you need that first family in comics to be on the shelves, because what? It's been like 3-4 years since the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, whenever James Robinson had a pretty good run, but that was it, I think, you know?
Yeah, that was about it. But if you can't get your flagship character right, like Spider-Man. Spider-Man is their flagship character. You have to get him right. Once you get your flagship character like that right, everything kind of falls into place. It's what's happening over at DC right now with Superman.
Yeah.
Bendis is doing a great job on Superman. It's all falling into place.
That was my next question, actually. I was going to say to you, Bendis, one of the biggest names in the industry, moving to DC from Marvel, what has that meant for you sales-wise? Have you seen a lot of people pick up Superman with his entry?
Yep. Man of Steel did really, really well for us. He only did what a bit of a story in Action 1000, or was it the hardcover? One or the other.
He had a little backup in one of those ones. I think it was 1000. I think, and then he had the Man of Steel mini.
I mean, Action 1000 was going to sell well anyway.
Sure.
First Western comic to hit that mark, that issue number. But anything Bendis has actually solicited through DC has been going really well for us. I've got a lot of pre-orders for stuff like Pearl. Mm-hmm. Cover, I think. Basically, a lot of people just telling me, you know what? They're hoping that this kind of refreshes Bendis. To him going over to DC might be like him going back to the way he was when he was first writing Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah, when he was good, basically.
Ultimate Spider-Man was excellent.
Oh, it was amazing. Like, I'm really a huge fan of Bendis on Ultimate Spider-Man, his Daredevil, his New Avengers, actually. But
absolutely,
his later days at Marvel, I mean, I think like anyone, it was like you're doing the same thing for the third time, you know, or the second time. Everything's a repeat. That's got to be tough as a writer at times, you know, to stay invested.
I think writers are the ones that have it the worst, especially when the publisher that's hired you is rebooting something on almost a yearly basis. What does that do to a writer when you've got this character and you've got stories nailed down for the next 18 months or 2 years, and all of a sudden an entire, you know, line-wide reboot comes in and trashes all your stories?
I think it would suck. And then they're like, and just start again, you know, and then like, and just do it again like you did before, please, 5 years ago. Yeah, it's like,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but this time do it with him instead, or this or that, or make sure it goes in this direction or that direction. It's not a mess. I mean, you understand, I guess, why people, creators, go to Image Comics or go to Dark Horse or go
for sure.
Somewhere else.
Yeah. He is a case in point that has – he may well have done something in Image I don't know about, but he's a case in point who's pretty much stayed at the primary publishers for the majority of his career, isn't he, Bendis? I mean, his indie work is mostly through, well, was through Marvel, wasn't it? Like Powers and all that? I'm not sure.
I remember some of his stuff getting printed at Image, but mostly it's been Marvel, yeah. I mean, Marvel has been very, very good to Bendis.
It sounds like his DC deal is pretty good, too. I listened to Word Balloon. It sounds like his DC deal is pretty sweet as well, the kind of stuff he's got coming out.
I think so. I mean, he's been given the keys to Superman.
Yeah.
Like, not just Superman, but associated characters as well. And I think we might be seeing Bendis do kind of what Geoff Johns did back in the day with the Green Lantern titles.
Really?
He wants to do now with, you know, Justice League, etc.
Sure.
I think giving Bendis the keys to that and watch him eventually work his way to Batman, because everyone does.
Yeah.
You know, he'll I think DC did the smart thing getting him on board, giving him Superman and just letting him run with it and see where they go.
Oh, definitely. And now, can I ask, are you a Superman guy? I'm sort of not, but I appreciate him, sort of thing. But I must admit, for me, Superman on a month-to-month basis has always been a tough read. But are you a Superman guy?
Yeah, no, look, I agree. I think I like Superman in kind of short bursts, you know, mini-series or whatnot.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my favourite comic books, one of my favorite stories ever is Superman for All Seasons.
Fantastic book. Great book.
You know, it's, again, Tim Sale, I'll anything the man does, I'll be there. But reading Superman on a monthly or even these days, what is a fortnightly kind of schedule, I don't think I can do that anymore. But then I'm not sure I can do that with Batman anymore.
I do it with Batman, but I'm a bit like Batman's in my blood a little bit. You know what I mean? Like the first comic I ever got was Dark Knight Returns. Sort of like I'm invested in the whole thing. I've got a question for you. Is Superman, because I remember reading, like I'd get like old copies in the 80s, and for a long time DC in the letter page would say Superman's our best-selling book, always. And I always thought it's not, it's Batman. These days, is Superman still one of the top sellers? Is he right up there? Does he push Batman real close? You know, where is he?
Nobody comes close to Batman. Whether it's a DC book or a Marvel book, for us, nobody comes close to Batman. Batman sells twice as many comics as his closest competitor.
That's amazing, isn't it? Like, that just shows you that just the Batman brand, it just doesn't seem to weaken, you know, no matter what seems to happen. Yeah.
It hasn't, but that's not to say that Superman isn't successful. Superman is always in, you know, Action Comics and Superman are always in our top 10 sellers.
Yeah.
But to get to Batman numbers, you're going to have to do something pretty damn special, and hopefully it's not killing him again.
Did Bendis coming on punch it up?
It did. Yeah, it maybe punched it up by about 25%.
Okay,
and,
all right.
Those numbers are obviously going to kind of taper off as the series keeps going. The interest right now, I think, I mean, it was good to see DC reboot Superman with a new number one, but a lot more people, I think, are reading Action Comics.
Okay.
Than Superman.
And is Bendis doing both?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's cool that he's doing Superman and Action, because he can kind of keep the story, you know, he can kind of run with it.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's the two big ones. DC have given him both.
Oh, that's cool. Now, I've got a question. One of my favorite things is like the classic moment where the customer has had enough. And that's not my Batman or that's not my Superman. For me, it was when Frank Castle turned into the zombie. And I remember I was in store and I was really depressed. I go, this isn't my Punisher.
Well, Frank Castle.
I as a Punisher fan, I just for me, and I'm very sort of like, I don't go to the extremes, but I was in the store and I went, cancel it. It's just not my Punisher. But it was more like a tear running down. It wasn't like, it's not my Punisher. It was more like, it's not my Punisher.
That's hilarious, man. That was one of the funniest things I've ever seen Marvel do. You're telling me that was worse than when they made him an angel of vengeance?
Well, thankfully, I was actually out of comics at that moment. Like, that was when I wasn't reading. And yes, that would have been worse, I agree. And I actually the thing was, when Rick Remender did that, I love Rick Remender and I loved his Punisher up to then, but I was just completely surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I was like, I was the guy who didn't read any of the solicits and it just came as like the world's biggest surprise. But you must have some hilarious stories of rants, Jim. Have you had a few classics in your time, you know?
I've been threatened with somebody threatened to stab me once.
Really? Why you? What have you done wrong?
Well, obviously, you know, I'm in charge of comics.
Oh, yeah, I see. You make them all behind closed doors, don't you?
Someone threatened to stab me once over something that had been done in a Phantom comic.
Okay. You know? Clearly your fault.
that's the worst. But, there have been a lot of... I think especially when Marvel gave their major characters to... You know, Steve Rogers is gone, so there was another Captain America. Tony Stark was gone, so there was another Iron Man. Sure. Thor became a woman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. Anytime something changes the status quo like that, we get some negativity, but it's become a lot less over the years. I think people have started to become more accepting of, you know what, these aren't entirely our characters, and the publishers will do what they will with them. Just because something or a character changes doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be bad.
And also, it usually doesn't mean it will last too long either. Like, you know, I remember when Spider-Man turned into Doc Ock, I was kind of like, this is a cool story. I doubt he's going to stay Doc Ock forever, you know?
Awesome.
Yeah, I loved it personally, yeah. Spider-Man.
Which is why I'm happy that, you know, we're going to get a Superior Doctor Octopus series later in the year.
Is that going to be Doc Ock as – what's the concept behind that one? Is he going to be Spider-Man or what?
I think it's going to be kind of the Hydra Doc Ock.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. There's been a solicitation, but not much information given to us as of yet.
Okay.
But hasn't it kind of always been the way that when – especially a long-established character changes, people will say, hey, that's not my Superman, that's not my Cap, that's not my Doctor Strange, etc. Fine, but you also have to understand that these comic book publishers maybe aren't writing these books for you anymore.
I agree. It's such a tricky balance. I've actually got a couple more.
To keep long-time fans happy and get new people coming in to read about these characters as well. It's a very delicate balance, and unfortunately, it doesn't always work.
No, I was going to say that sometimes the comic book companies themselves aren't very good at managing that balance, I would say. You know,
no, that's absolutely true. But in the back of my mind, I've always had this whenever there's been a major character change or whatnot, it's always been kind of a James Bond thing for me.
Sure.
Different actor. Same character.
Yeah. I mean, Sean Connery is not James Bond anymore. We've grown to accept it in the intervening 50 years, you know.
I mean, this is why I think we should grow to accept that, hey, these characters are going to change, even if we as readers don't.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's very interesting. With the way Image reposition themselves in, say, the last 10 years with books like Walking Dead and a lot of major talent walking away from Marvel in particular, how has that translated for you? I know bookstores did great business with Walking Dead hardcovers. Is it the same for you? Did you sell a stack of Walking Dead hardcovers and that kind of stuff?
We sell a stack of Walking Dead no matter what.
Yeah.
The TV series helped a lot. But, you know, putting Jim Valentino in charge of the creative side of Image Comics was just a masterstroke. Mm. He's the one that gave us The Walking Dead. He's the one that gave us Saga. He gave us all these great Image Comics. And when the when the Walking Dead TV show started, we just could not keep enough trade paperbacks and hardcovers in stock.
What a great problem to have.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, it's obviously slowed down a bit over the years because people have caught up. But out of all the titles that Image Comics release, you know, Saga's probably our number one, Walking Dead is number two.
Okay, well, that's great. I think both are fantastic. I mean, we're going to do – I mean, Saga I'm not 100% up to date with, but I'm not too far behind. Walking Dead – I've read the first few hardcovers, but we're going to start doing it on the show hardcover by hardcover Because I think, I think the comic is something special, and my girlfriend and I, we're so invested in that show by this point. We are the fucking Walking Dead by this point. Like, there was a moment in the show where one of them yelled out, "We are the Walking Dead," and I turned to her and go, "Are we going to continue? Now's the point. Do we continue or do we just turn it off?"
Yep. Yeah, let's stop it now.
Here's a question for you. I know I've got a couple of questions about the ordering process because I'm fascinated by the economics of stores. Outside of your big names for Image, like your Kirkmans, your Hickman, Fraction, Kelly Sue, when you get a book, say, from a respected name like an Alex Cott on New World One or perhaps a creator with not much name recognition but it seems like a fun concept, how do you know how much to order? Is there a threshold for like an unknown Image creative team? Like, how do you do that?
Oh, man, unfortunately, a lot of the times it's a crapshoot. Mm. You got to take your best guess. And when it comes to comic books, I mean, we do the best we can by going off the stats that we have at work and, you know, trying to order that way. But when it's a new creative team on a new title, doesn't matter who's publishing it, whether it's DC or Image or, you know, Antarctic Press, you're doing a best guess kind of thing. And if you're lucky, the publisher will give you an option of, say, you know, order X amount of copies and whatever you don't sell, you can return.
Oh, okay. I thought they didn't do that, but they do that sometimes, do they?
The major publishers don't, but there are guys like Dark Horse Comics who, especially the Karen Berger, the Berger books that are happening now, they want people to read them. So they're giving us the extra option of, you know, order 20, 30, 40, 50 copies.
Sure.
And what you don't sell, you can return.
Well, that's good.
And I think that's fantastic. Because that actually encourages retailers like us to give new. Marvel and DC don't need that because they're the big two. Image Comics, to a point, they don't do it anymore either, but IDW does. IDW, I love what they do because most of the time, they will say, "Hey, we'd like you to read this. We think it's going to be great. For the first 2-3 issues, we'll do full returns."
Okay. I've actually got a question about IDW. I've noticed them, some of the stuff they do, man, with the licensed properties and everything, I actually think they are a really strong performer that don't get enough credit. Like their Transformers stuff, for example, their G.I. Joe. I mean, in Australia, in Kings, how do these kind of things translate in sales? Do they sometimes compete with the big boys? Because I imagine they might.
G.I. Joe doesn't really, mainly because it's
US-based.
Such an American thing. Yeah. Transformers comics have always sold well for us. Even, you know, back in the day of, DreamWorks? As the guys that originally did it. It was when we were at Fox Studios. But we have always done well with Transformers comics no matter what because, I mean, it's probably the biggest Hasbro line there is, we sell the toy well and the comics really, really well. But you know, when you're talking about that, we also do really well with Orphan Black.
Okay, which the TV show. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, they do a lot of licensed stuff, IDW, and I think a lot of it's pretty high quality, frankly.
Back to the Future, man. Back to the Future was huge for us, absolutely massive.
See, there you go.
You know, licensed stuff either does really, really well or just kind of dies really quickly.
Well, it used to have a bad name. When I was collecting in the early 2000s, you wouldn't go near, like, a lot of the licensed stuff. But I think a lot's changed, man. Like, I think, you know, you're the guy with the numbers, but my perception when I look at the stuff they publish, I mean, they're publishing multiple lines of Transformers, for example. You know, there's a lot going on. Yeah.
But they're doing that, I think, because they have a story to tell and it's not going to be told really well in just one series. They need the 3 or 4 different titles to round everything out. I think it's especially over the last year, people have been cottoning on that the Transformers comics that IDW are doing are actually really, really good.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, really good.
Exactly.
And we're seeing our trade paperback sales go through the roof. Because people are trying to catch up with it.
Yeah, yeah. It will be interesting when with the movie, they're rebooting it basically, and so Hasbro will be putting out, you know, there will be a new Transformers kind of line, not directed by Michael Bay. It'll be interesting to see how that sort of translates, you know? Because I can't stand those Michael Bay Transformer movies, personally.
I couldn't get through the first one, let alone the other 17 he directed. I think what they're doing with the Bumblebee film is a step in the right direction.
Oh, definitely. It's a bit of a palate cleanser too, I think. I think they need that refresher to go back to generation kind of one sort of style for the audience.
Doing some cheap stuff and slightly less complicated than what Michael Bay had in mind when it comes to what the Transformers movie should be.
I shouldn't be sitting in a 2.5-hour action movie bored out of my brain, you know, which is how, like, I'm an hour and a half in and I'm bored to tears.
I think, because I got taken along to the movies, to the cinemas to see the first one. I'm pretty sure I fell asleep in it.
Oh, really? And that was the best one, Jim, to be honest.
Was it?
Yeah, that was easily the best one. I've always thought if I had your job, I would turn into, you remember the DC villain, the Calculator? That would become me with all this ordering.
Of course. Except, you know, I'm old enough that I'd be the abacus.
the abacus. In your pyramid. Now, since obviously we had back in the early 2000s X-Men and the original Spider-Man movies, things have kind of lit the torch. Things have gone gangbusters in Hollywood since Iron Man, really, in 2008. They've got to have sold, God knows how much, over $10 billion in sales, if not more, with Marvel and DC. But comic sales are way down across the line, and we see a lot of articles on this, like sort of, I mean, what... I sort of, the question I have, Jimmy, is like, it's to do with marketing. Do you think DC and Marvel do enough to market their publishing line at the same time that their movies are making so much money? Do you think there should be more initiative shown to sort of get the comics out there to the people who watch the movies?
It's difficult. It really is, especially when it comes to the movies themselves. Mm. To get people to go to a movie and pay, you know, the $15 or $20 for a ticket.
Sure.
And then expect them to go to a bookstore and slap down another $50 or whatever on books. I think people who – the majority of people who will go to watch a Marvel film are not the people who will collect comic books.
Yeah. Two different audiences, you think?
It is. It is two different audiences. You know, the hardcore fans, obviously, the people who have been reading Iron Man or whatever for years and years, will go see the movie and continue to buy comics. But for the majority of the casual, moviegoers going to see an Iron Man film, they're probably not going to want to go to buy a comic book, especially when you're buying a comic from a publisher who has more than 50 years of history.
Sure, but do you not think it's somewhat of a missed opportunity, though? Like, I just feel like there's a marketing missed opportunity. Like, I was saying on the show, when the Avengers Infinity War came out, you remember how everyone was talking Avengers Infinity War before it came out? It was one of those movies that was like a must-see. My idea was, like, why not with every ticket of Avengers Infinity War, they included the Jason Aaron number one, either as a digital or as a paper comic with every single ticket. Like, I feel like these guys are making enough money.
We've actually helped out with that before. There have been cinemas who have requested, 1,000 copies of an X-Men book or an Avengers book or whatever, to do exactly what you just said. But the thing is, it's the cinemas that are arranging stuff like that and not the distributors.
Yeah.
Not the guys who make the movies, which is so weird.
They leave it to the cinema chains themselves.
Yeah, they basically, once the movie sees release, it's kind of like, oh, it's out of our hands now. You guys do what you want.
Yeah.
Which is really, really strange.
I just wonder, I know all bubbles burst, but there's probably another 10 years in comic book movies being as big as they are. If I look at the trends, probably 10 to 15 years they'll milk it. You know what I mean? Around that time span. And I just wonder. Sorry?
Look how long Westerns were in movies or, physicals or Dirty Harry type films, etc. The way I've seen it over the last 18-20 years, the industry kind of has its peaks and troughs, and it seems to be every decade or so it slows down a bit, then it picks up, then it slows down again. And it's the same for the movie side of things for them as well. But I kind of forget where I was going with this.
Well, my thing is, though, like, I mean, because we do box office analysis quite a lot on Signal of Doom. And, like, for example, Solo disappointed. Now, I do think that if they had three bombs in a row, which could happen with DC, like Shazam may not land, you know, then they really suddenly studios, they back away pretty quickly. They jump off trends pretty quick. Like Marvel will keep making money for at least 10 years. Like the Marvel studios, they're in no danger. Well, but, you know,
now that they have Disney behind them, of course.
Yes. But the DC movie universe, you know, is more complicated and a bit more troubled. Like Justice League didn't make money. Aquaman, you hope would. Shazam, I'm on the show as saying I think will bomb. I could be wrong, but I hope, you know.
Because I want to see that movie so badly.
Oh, yeah. And it's got a fun trailer. It's got a fun, you know, they're doing B again.
I'm a Shazam fan way back to, you know, when he was still known as Captain Marvel.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started on how they've tried to fucking manipulate our brains to figure. I really actually hate that. Like, that, like, oh, he was never called Captain Marvel. Oh, no. That's just in your imagination, kids. It's like bullshit. He was called it till the New 52, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. This is a character who outsold Superman in the Golden Age.
I know.
So, I mean, having him actually come to the fore with a movie, and for me, it's been described perfectly as that Tom Hanks film, Big, but with superpowers. I'm like, yes, this is what I want. This is what I want to see. And hopefully it doesn't tank, because this is what we kind of need every so often. We need a movie like this. We need a movie like, you know, Marvel gave us with Deadpool or Ant-Man.
Oh, yeah.
I think DC needs a movie like Shazam.
Oh, they definitely do. The studio needs it, and I, you know, hope it does well. But I was just, I pinpoint and look at things that potentially may lose. The trailer, I think, helps its cause, but they need to connect with the kids, and who knows if the kids will connect with Shazam. That's the thing. They're putting a lot of faith in these kids, and, you know, it might explode. That's the thing. It may well explode. It's definitely going for comedy, which is good, you know?
I mean, fingers crossed the Shazam movie goes really, really well, and people get some interest in the character. The only drawback I can think of right now is that DC doesn't have a lot of his, you know, Shazam stuff in print. People will come into our store and say, hey, can you give me some Shazam comics? And we're just going to be like, nah.
They've got one from the guy who did, I don't know his name, he did Bone.
Jeff Smith, yeah.
Yes, there's a very good Shazam, but you're right, there's not a ton of Shazam product out there. I believe they are reprinting some of the 70s stuff, or maybe no, the original stuff is getting a reprint, I think, late this year, early next year, I think.
I hope so. I hope that DC also do another version of the New 52 Shazam, because that's going to be closer to, you know, what people see in the cinemas.
Oh, you need a book out there. You need a fucking monthly book out there if you're going to do a movie.
Either that or put him in a team.
That's a good point, Jim, actually. That's a very good point. Like, you've got, say, with all these group books at Justice League, you think you could slot him in somewhere, couldn't you?
Put him into a Justice League book. Whether he's magic-based, put him into Justice League Dark.
Yes, that's a very good point, Jim, actually. And that takes pressure off him and puts it in sort of with other characters, Zatanna's, Wonder Woman, Constantine. All these are reasonably big names.
Similar type characters, as far as the magic is concerned. And that way that, you know, you don't need a solo title which may only last, you know, like 9 or 10 issues.
No, that's a very good point. Now, Jim, when I walk into King's, I'm hit like by a stack of comics and trades. Now, I'm hit also by some sweet merchandise and action figures, statues, clothes, etc. As the guy who's managing it, how big a part, I mean, without giving actual numbers, of your quarterly results is about shifting the merchandise these days? Is that like, because Stu, my colleague, he reckons that Funko Pop drives the world. Is that true? Like, you know, like, as a retailer, is that a huge part of your business now?
Not right now. Like the comic book industry, like the comics themselves, where, you know, sales rise and drop, it's the same thing for merchandise. Right now, I'm actually focusing more on single issues and trade paperbacks than I am on collectibles.
Okay.
Because it's just that kind of
cycle.
Just that kind of a cycle right now. In fact, I'm ordering the least amount of Funko Pop vinyls that I ever have.
Could they potentially have, I mean, I'm not a collector, but I'm like anyone else, I can see just how, you know, much they've got out there. Could they have hit that saturation point where it's like, I saw Taika Waititi was a Funko Pop figure and I'm like, really? Yeah. Like, you know?
Yeah, I think they've gotten to the point. There was, I think, what was it, San Diego Comic-Con last week?
Mm-hmm.
They were selling pop vinyls, which were just pretty much spray-painted gold.
Really?
Yeah, so, you know, when you get to the point of where you're selling your own product but not even bothering to put details on it,
yeah,
I think saturation point has been hit.
When they do one of you, Jim, I'll buy it. They do Jimmy King's Comics Funko Pop.
I had that idea not that long ago. I'm thinking, should I? No. But then I got in touch with Funko, and they said, well, we could do something like that, but minimum production run of 10,000. I thought, no, that's just too many Jims in the world.
Now, my co-host Stu is back again with another killer question. He's always got, like, the tough questions. I do, like, the nuts and bolts of the podcast, and then he comes in with sort of spike the ball kind of stuff. Now, he's got here... Apart from the obvious question of how does Jim see the industry changing for collectors, i.e. scrapping singles for trades, how, Jim, do you recommend someone collects comics? Is it via omnibuses every few months, trades every few weeks, or singles every week? What's better for the bottom line of the store and the industry as a whole? That's a big question from Stu. I'll turn it over to you.
It really is different for everyone. I try to kind of cater to... everybody's different financial situation.
Sure, that's got to be tough.
it is, but you know, when people you get people coming in wanting to start a standing order with us or just to collect something, I ask them, you know, do you want to collect single issues? Do you want these things? Read them and put them away for later, or do you just want something on your bookshelves that you can go to at any time? Mm-hmm. And yeah, you just kind of work around people. Right now, the way I see it, I think we're on the last generation of dedicated single issue collectors. As much as the current generation of collectors want to pass on their, you know, experience and say, you know, you should have an unbroken run of this or unbroken run of that. It's not the same industry anymore. I think it's becoming more and more of people wanting to pick up an entire storyline at once.
Yeah, that's me, for example. That's me. It's been me for 20 years,
well,
you know.
That's the thing. People don't want to, pick up a single issue off the shelf, which is either starting a six-month-long storyline or is in the middle of a six-month storyline. They'd rather go to one of our, you know, trade paperback shelves, grab the latest volume of Batman and read it as one big block. That's, I think, where it's heading right now.
Do you get a lot of parents coming in, you know, for little Jimmy or little Sally to, you know, oh, he loves Spider-Man or he loves Guardians? Do you get that? Yeah,
all the time, man. Weekly.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
It is good. It's nice that I think DC and Marvel have finally picked up their game and started publishing more younger reader stuff.
Yeah.
Although when somebody does come in asking for young reader books, I will usually throw them towards Boom Studios because they do the best young reader stuff in the industry.
What about the Archie comics these days? They're very – I think Archie have done some really amazing things in the last, like, 5 years. You know, there's been
Archie.
I love
it. That's been so much fun to read. And the way they've rebooted Sabrina, I think, has been great as well.
Agreed.
The fact that I couldn't, for the life of me, picture Archie Comics doing horror stuff 5 years ago. No way.
When I was growing up, Archie were kind of like, they were like grandpa comics, you know, like they were sort of like back in the 50s, Willie Go with Betty or Veronica, and Juggy was there. Like it was fun, but it wasn't anything that would give you pause. But now it's kind of like, wow, these guys are really playing with the big boys, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, having the Riverdale TV show as well has brought a lot of people in.
That's fantastic. I love that show. I think that's a fantastic show.
And I think they did the really smart thing because... Right now, they're still publishing these, you know, kind of rebooted titles, as well as the classic versions of Archie and Betty and Veronica as well. So they're doing the right thing because they're doing the right thing by their old audience and by their new.
Yeah, agreed, agreed. That's a very good point. Now, Jim, I've got a bit of a little one here. It comes up on the show. Look, I've marched in a lot of causes when I was, well, not a lot, but a few causes, reasonably progressive. But I must admit, like PC culture, identity politics, all that stuff, it has latched onto comic books and been a big thing in the last few years. And even doing the show, you very much get, like on Twitter, controversy of the week. I wonder, does that hit the store at any point? Like, do you become the Sam Malone, basically, instead of pulling beers, you're selling comics while all these people are, like, you know, chirping back and forth? Does that actually happen, or does it not happen at all in the store?
It does, but I guess I don't know how to answer this.
It's a tough one, man, because, like, let me tell you, as someone who is fairly progressive, I must admit, I got told ninjas were offensive on the last show, and I was like, well, fuck off. They're not offensive, but apparently they are offensive now. You know, PC culture is...
offensive or what? I mean...
Like, they're just... basically, I was told that, like, unless the ninja is, like, 100% Asian authentic, you know, born in Japan, raised in Japan, it's offensive. And I was like, well, I'm not offended. And then I was told, but you're, you know... Then I was given the PC speech. But what I'm trying to say is, like, we have gone a long way that direction. There's kind of that Twitter audience, man. Like, they're very vocal. And I always wonder, like, in the store, does this break out in the store? Do you get, like, people, like, does it actually break out in the store kind of thing? Or is it all just on the internet? I always wonder.
Most of it's on the internet. Sure. We have had situations in the store where, you know, I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Of course.
That's all it is. It's just an opinion. It doesn't mean you're right or you're wrong.
Mm.
But we have had people in our store become, I guess, just overly aggressive about it.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Whether they're for it or against it, I get that. But at the same time, we're a comic book store. We're here to have, you know, just to chill and have fun and read about the adventures of our favorite superheroes or supervillains. And
yeah.
Getting into that kind of...
it's murky territory, basically.
Yeah, it can be a bit murky, man, and it can be a bit tough.
Yeah.
But what can you do? I mean...
Well, I just wondered because I sometimes imagine, are you there trying to sell fucking a copy of Superman and people are, like, arguing about it, and you're like... And I just imagine Sam Malone at Cheers. Is that what it turns into?
Sometimes... And go, dude, it's just a comic book.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
It just, I get the love behind the characters and I get that. But, dude, at the end of the day, it's just a comic book.
It's here to be read and then sort of almost forgotten about because next week there'll be just another thing, you know? I've got a funny story. Do you know C.D. Sabowski, who took over at Marvel editorial, the chief editor at Marvel now, C.B. Sabowski? When he got hired, there was like a controversy of the minute because... he had written under a persona, you know, many years before. Anyway, and so the story broke, and so I'm hearing it, and I'm just don't care. And then suddenly I realized I had the comic, I had the trade, and I was so excited. And I went on, I pumped it on the show, like, if you want this controversial comic, I'm going to put it on eBay. I put it on eBay, put all this, like, shit behind it. No one was interested. And I was like, I thought I had the book of the moment, you know what I mean?
But that's a thing there. Exactly what you just said, though. I mean, of the moment.
Yeah.
That speculation is something that I think is very damaging.
Sure. I'm a part of the problem, Jim. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes. No.
Thank you.
Little things like that. I've had occasions where people have come in and wanted to buy us out of a certain title, or a certain issue.
Completely out. Like, I want 100 issues of Batman or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What do you do? Do you just sell it to them? Are you just like, okay?
No, hell no. I say hell no.
Okay. Wow. You take a stand, man.
I'm not going to sell you 100 copies of, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Because, A, you're just going to go online and some at a marked up price, and B, that doesn't give anybody else the chance to read it.
Yeah, that's a good point, man. That's a good point. These guys have got a lot of fucking time on their hands. Like, I mean, I honestly wouldn't have the patience. Like, I've been in comic book lines, you know. I'm not a big signature guy, but I've got a couple in my time. I got Chris Claremont once. I got Grant Morrison once and someone else, like, once. But I'm in the line for Chris Claremont, and this fucking guy had a shopping trolley ahead of me packed with comics and wouldn't shut up complaining about something. And then he, like, expected Chris Claremont to sign, like, hundreds of issues, which apparently he was then going to flip on eBay. And I'm just sitting behind him, and I felt so stupid. I had, like, a trade. And I'm like, can you just sign my trade of life, death? Like, oh, what could I do?
I kind of had the same thing with Tim Sale, where a guy in front of me and the guy behind me had, like, suitcases of stuff.
Yeah.
But when I hit a creator that I love, I get them to personalize it.
Yeah, yeah. Greg Rucker, it's personalized for me, man. Greg Rucker, I met him once. He blew my mind, dude, with his depth and his warmth. And the stuff he wrote in the comic book, like, you know, at the start of the trades, I was like, man, I was truly touched. Like, you know, it actually warmed my heart.
Greg Rucker, because we had him on a couple of our booths at some conventions, him and Nicholas Scott. Greg Rucker was one of those guys who was just scary smart and also just had a huge heart.
Yeah.
But I also love the fact that he was also one of those guys who kind of just stuck to his guns. So whenever somebody asked him an opinion of something, he'd always, you know, tell him what's on his mind. Being American helps. But he was just an awesome, awesome kind of guy. I've always got time for Greg Rucker, no matter what.
Oh, yeah. For me, he's like, just in terms of his work, it's always high quality. I put him and Ed Brubaker on the same threshold. It's always quality. You know what I mean? Like, but you're right. Like, and he's been through the wars too. When you chat to Greg Rucker, you get the impression he's been through the grind of the industry, and it's not always been an easy ride. You know,
not just our industry, but the because he wrote and still does. He writes crime novels.
Yeah, so good ones.
Been on the other kind of publisher side of the industry as well.
Mm. No, his Atticus Kodiak novels are fantastic. Yeah, he's a very gifted writer. A lot of people should actually, if they ever want to get a good Greg Rucker book, he wrote a novelization of No Man's Land, which I would always recommend if you get your hands on it.
I've got that somewhere, yes.
Yeah, me too. But, it's, I mean, it's gold.
If people haven't read Queen and Country, and if people haven't read Stumptown, you're missing out on the best goddamn comics. I love that series, and Greg Rucker does a great job on it.
Yeah, we're basically the Greg Rucker podcast at times, Jim. So that's that's good.
Yeah, Greg, you didn't send me my check last month. I'd like that.
Ooh. I'm actually chasing Greg Rucker for the show. Actually, we'd love to have Greg Rucker on. You know, he's a challenging man to get, but we are definitely actually trying to line him up for the show.
It'd be a very busy man.
But he's heaps busy. He's heaps busy, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he's probably just trying to clear a schedule right now, Jim. You know what I'm saying? He's probably in the States right now. I've just got to finish this to get on Signal of Doom.
I heard Jim was on there, so, you know, I'll have to get on there as well.
Yeah. Now, I've got a funny one for you, Jim. This kind of dovetails back into what we were talking about before. There was a financial guy at Marvel at a retailer summit who kind of gave a quote saying they pushed hard into diverse lineups and it didn't sell, basically was his quote. And he was kind of savaged online for it. But I kind of, as someone who works in finance, I kind of felt for him because I'm like, the guy's just reporting on the numbers to retailers and, like, if it doesn't sell, it doesn't sell. Like, it wasn't like a political statement. But I've always felt, Jim, that the big two publishers don't seem to realize that a balanced line, you can cater to more than one audience. Like, if you have a truly balanced line.
Well, as far as him talking about numbers for retailers, was he talking about American or non-American? Because
He's talking about American. He was at like a retailer summit. It was about a year and a half ago.
Because the American side of retail, as far, you know, when it comes to comic book industry, the American side of retail is far different to the rest of the world.
Sure, different experience.
Things that sell really, really well over there, sometimes we just can't give away.
Yeah.
So anytime there have been, you know, major changes in characters or major replacements of characters. We found, you know, obviously that first issue or two will sell fantastically and the numbers will drop off, but it depends on the series and how well it's written.
Of course, like Jason Aaron's Thor. I mean, I consider Jason Aaron pretty much the premier writer still left at Marvel. And, I mean, did his Thor continue selling well when Jane Foster came in? I would have thought so.
Absolutely. Actually, actually our numbers increased.
Yeah, I'm not surprised because it was a very, very good comic.
We started selling probably upwards of 30% more than what we were selling before Jane Foster came along.
Yeah, man, that's one thing I want. When Jason Aaron, we do it on the show a bit. If you look at Jason Aaron's Marvel work, it's amazing his level of quality. Like his Wolverine X-Men, all his Wolverine work, his Thor work, and now he's on Avengers. He really is kind of a linchpin that sometimes doesn't get the name recognition that, like, say, the Fractions got previously.
I think going back to what we were saying before about Bendis, him leaving, I think, was actually quite damaging to Marvel. And you could almost hear the scrambling around of, like, who's going to take his place? Who are we going to push up to that Bendis status for Marvel? And damn it, you're right. It should be Jason Aaron. He should be up there.
Oh, I just think I look at people in terms of what's hit and what's been big, and he's actually been behind a lot of good titles. He just doesn't have the same public presence that like a Bendis had, you know, like, you know, always on Twitter, always online, you know.
That I don't think he's been pushed as heavily.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah.
You Interesting. Know, by Marvel.
Yeah, it's a good point, and I guess now he will be. He's on Avengers now, so it's I guess kind of like that's the premier title, would you say, at the moment?
Yeah. Spidey for us is still the premier Marvel title.
Oh, really? Avengers, that's cool. I'm wearing a Spider-Man T-shirt.
Avengers is a close second, but Spidey still outsells it.
That puts a smile on my face because I always on the show I always throw the line down that Spider-Man's the marketable flagship character.
It's a difficult thing. Not everyone can get up to the level of, say, you know, Savage Dragon, but they're trying, and they'll get there in the end. What
number is Savage Dragon on? Because it's got to have been going since the 90s by this point, isn't it?
We're getting closer to 50.
Okay. Well, it's a very impressive effort by Eric Larson to keep that title going as long as he has, you know?
I think, I was collecting it when it first started just because, hey, it was Image Comics and it was something exciting.
Sure.
But Eric Larson has that, you know, the Savage Dragon series has become my monthly Silver Age, goofy, awesome, laugh-out-loud kind of comic book. You know, addiction. It's what comics should be. It's fun. It's stupid. We know it's not X-Men, but it's there to be enjoyed. And it's also one of the few comic books that works in real time.
Oh, really?
Over the 20 years it's been going, Savage Dragon has been released with the characters working in our time.
Wow. I did not know that. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
It's a risk. It was a big risk he took, but it paid off.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, yeah, no, thank God for Eric Larson. I think it's fantastic. He was one of the original Image guys, wasn't he? Like one of the original guys who went across, yeah. Okay, now I've got a couple of questions for you. In terms of a trade or collected, you know, edition, so any form of collected edition or trade, if you have to take a stab, what do you think has been your best-selling trade? Like, as in it's still on shelves or whatever. Like, if you have to take a stab, what do you reckon it's been?
Watchmen.
That was actually my guess. I was like, is that because everyone's like... I sometimes find it hilarious when you get the articles of like, this is the comic that like is more than a comic. Like, this is a comic you can actually read and all that kind of shit they always say. Like, is it a product of that advertising sort of thing? Like, it's always mentioned.
I found, because, you know, I've done a lot of conventions as well over the years, and we've bought enough copies of Watchmen, I think, over the last 10 years that we could probably build a house out of them. And I thought to myself a while back, come on, it's got to be one of those books like that everyone has. Every household's got to have a copy. And yet it keeps going and going and selling and selling and selling.
It's good.
It's that book that I think that we will never ever have to, you know, if we will always have to reorder. We will always have to have on our shelves Watchmen and possibly Dark Knight Returns.
See, for me, I'm a Dark Knight guy. It was the first trade I ever got. It was on the shelf in about 87. I picked it up, and it's informed my reading ever since. And I'm so stubborn. I didn't read Watchmen. I owned it. I bought it from you, Jim, actually, and I never read it. I never read it until the movie, and I read it like a week before the movie, and I was like, this is actually pretty good.
Look, people are still to this day think it's, you know, rightly so, I guess. They say, you know, it's Alan Moore's best. Personally, for me, it's not. I think what he did with his ABC line of comics was a lot better.
Is that the Tom Strong stuff?
Like Promethea.
Yeah. Have you ever read Tom Strong?
Tom Strong's one of my favorite comics. I love Tom Strong.
I love that,
Tom Strong, Top Ten, and Promethea were brilliant, brilliant comics.
He's a very, very, very talented and very grumpy old man, isn't he? He's one of the biggest talents ever, you know.
But I think that's where he hit his mark and where he was at his peak as far as creativity and superheroes are concerned.
Mm.
That superhero trope, that's where he went. Watchmen was great, but I just thought his ABC stuff was so good.
Mm. Now, he's I go right back. I don't know if you've ever read 2000 AD. He's Halo Jones.
They've just started re-releasing color editions of that.
Oh, there you go. See, I read that as a kid, and it blew my mind. And I didn't even know who he was, you know. He's a super talent.
We've still got a really dedicated, hardcore 2000 AD fan base.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
They get the weekly, you know, magazine-style comics. They get the magazine. The IDW series sells well just because of the Judge Dredd name.
Yeah, and it's going to be on presumably a Netflix show reasonably soon. They're closing that deal.
Man, I hope so, because that Carl, was it that was the Carl Urban film?
The Carl Urban movie,
I thought that was brilliant.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And did you hear that Rogue Trooper is going to be directed by Duncan Jones?
Yes, Rouge Trooper.
Yeah.
Let's hope that I think we're going to see a fair bit of interest in that, because didn't they, I think is it Titan or Rebellion? Just put something up for free online for people to check out who the character is, and you should.
They definitely should. I mean, I pitched on the show already to my grumpy co-host who just doesn't know anything about 2000 AD. But if they do that Dredd TV show, my life might be complete. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just think, like, Dredd is so perfect for a TV show.
Dredd would be great, especially if you threw in the ABC Warriors.
Oh, yeah, Jim. Yeah, come on.
No, that'd be so much fun. And Judge Anderson in there. And,
of course.
And you start bringing out, you know, the Dark Judges.
Of course.
Great.
Of course. And there's so much material. Chopper. There's so much, man. Like, you know, I really just am hoping that happens. And what about I actually thought Watchmen might have been your answer. What about a trade like All Star Superman? Is that up there at all? Is that register?
It does, but I think less so, because there are better Superman stories.
Sure. Yeah. No. It was just my guess. And now we've got the trade Watchmen. In terms of a single issue, since you've been managing, which has been roughly, since about 2099, Jim, what do you reckon this best-selling single has been, if you have to take a guess, in store? Hard question?
Superman 75.
Okay, what's the significance there? Is that Death Of?
The Death Of.
Okay, right.
Yeah, remember the black bag?
Yep.
Yeah, that's probably the single issue we've sold the most, I'd say, in the time that I've been with the company anyway.
Okay.
That and it's a tough one, because single issues,
I was thinking maybe a New 52 title, because I remember I went into your store during New 52 and it was fucking nuts. People were just like,
New 52 was so good to us.
Yeah.
And it's also something that DC absolutely needed to do at the time.
Hmm.
They were long overdue for a reboot. So, you know, having this happen brought a lot of new readers in, and that was fantastic. But if we're talking about just sales-wise and numbers-wise over the time that I've been with Kings, I don't think anything much gets close to Superman 75 at all.
Okay.
We've gone through thousands of copies.
That's awesome, man. Jeez. Okay, there you go. That's the one which is the big, that's actually the death of, isn't it? Where it's a big fight issue. Yeah. Don't worry, kids. He comes back. He comes back, kids. It's okay, eventually.
It's better. It's okay. I mean,
you know. It's a death, inverted commas.
Throw him into like a tanning booth or something. He'll be fine in 10 minutes.
Jim, okay. Well, thank you so much for being on The Signal. Is there anything, give listeners actually the location of King's Comics if they don't know already. Like, so they've got to get down to your store, man. How do they get there?
Well, the store's at 310 Pitt Street, so, you know, getting off, if you're catching a train, either Town Hall or Museum Station, you can be at our store in 5 minutes, or just hit us at online at kingscomics.com.
Excellent. Jim, it has been an absolute privilege to have you on Signal of Doom. You're welcome back anytime.
Anytime you need me, man. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Jim.